Made in Sheffield, made by you.
This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday the 13th of April, 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch. I'm your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. We're broadcasting live on 93.2 FM and through our internet live stream. However you're listening, this programme will also be available as a podcast from the Sheffield Live podcast channel on the website. That is, if no black cats walk under ladders today, Friday the 13th. Are you superstitious? Does that affect how you run your business or social enterprise? Well, if you are, let me know. Send me a text, 07904 272 200. Find me, Jamie Veitch, on Twitter, or drop an email to jamie@sheffieldlive.org. If superstition affects you and how you run your business, then, well, I'd love to know. Send me your comments and I might even read them out today. So, what's coming up today? I'm really pleased that Jodie Marshall, Managing Director of A Mind Apart Theatre Company, is in the studio with us. And A Mind Apart is a fantastic social enterprise which uses performing arts to challenge, to inspire, to encourage and to change lives. And A Mind Apart is celebrating 10 years of existence, 10 years of impact. We're going to turn to Jodie in just a moment or two, but before we do that, what is going on in business and in social enterprise? Well, of course, the Easter holidays for many folk. Have you been taking a break? Have you had a well-earned rest? Or have you been hard at it, nose to the grindstone, like many business owners, like many social entrepreneurs? Again, get in touch. Tell us how holidays affect you. Do you take them? Or do you look wistfully as your employees take them, but you do not? Let me know. Few events are coming up next week. So it's the Quarterly Economic Review Breakfast. Every quarter, the Chambers, the Sheffield City Region Chambers, get together to host flagship events in partnership with the University Management School, and they share the Quarterly Economic Review results and what they mean for business. So next week on Tuesday, 17th of April, 8 a.m. through to 10 a.m, the next Quarterly Economic Review Breakfast, that's going to focus on recent issues with companies like Carillion, impending changes because of Brexit, Cash flow, loads of firms identifying cash flow as a risk and that being exacerbated by variable payment terms. We've been hearing about variable payment terms and government's desire to do something about that. But go along to the Quarterly Economic Review Breakfast if you want to hear from Greg Wright, Deputy Business Editor at the Yorkshire Post, Richard Wright, Chief Exec of Sheffield Chamber of Commerce, David Littlewood of Sheffield University Management School, and David Postlethwaite of HSBC. And there will then be a panel discussion about payment terms and cash flow. Fran Brody is there. Fran is MD of Brian Donkin Valves. Amy Cusworth, she's a solicitor at Oxley and Coward, and more. So well worth getting along to that event. What else coming up? Well, it's the Independent Business Fair, the Indie Business Fair, next Wednesday. And that's at the Workstation, the same building in which Sheffield Live is located. 9 a.m, you can meet, you can share and you connect with the best of Sheffield's independent, homegrown and creative businesses at that event. It's free to attend. You just need to register at Eventbrite, and I'll tweet the link out to that and to the quarterly economic survey event at the end of the programme from my Twitter account, Jamie Veitch. You don't have to have a Twitter account yourself. Just look up Twitter, go to twitter.com, find at Jamie Veitch, and you'll be able to see the links that I tweet out if you're interested in going along to the Independent Business Fair or the Quarterly Economic Survey Review Breakfast next week. A few other things coming up. Some business and information sessions being run by Business Sheffield that are free to attend. A whole load of those. Startup coaching, financial forecasting, tax record keeping, expenses, social media, sales, marketing, GDPR, and much, much more. more. Again, free to attend. All you need to do is take a look at Chef Business on Twitter, or look up welcometosheffield.co.uk/business to find out more details. Okay, so that's forthcoming events. Now, what else do I want to discuss before we bring our guest in? Well, perspective, a perspective change for business leaders can be crucial sometimes. And I was reminded of this last Sunday. There are loads of climbers here in Sheffield, and loads of climbers running businesses. I was climbing out in the Peak District on Sunday, attempting to make upward progress, and shortly before falling off. So I tried again, got back on the route, carried on climbing, and fell off again. But when I got back on the route I was climbing, instead of using the obvious footholds that were in front of me, I could put my feet on better positioned footholds, which are actually worse to stand up on. And that helped me to reduce the weight on my fingers and climb the hardest part of the route that I was attempting. It was actually the person who was holding the rope, who was belaying me, who spotted the worst footholds from the ground, because from the ground, he had a different perspective to me. He could spot what I was missing. And when I tried his suggestion of standing up on the worst footholds, it worked. And it reminded me that nuances in technique, of course, in rock climbing are fantastic. It's why I love it. But a change of perspective in business can sometimes prove really, really crucial. And sometimes you simply need someone to help you identify what to do to make progress. And we've talked about that a lot on this program, with people talking about the mentors that they've had, or how people who've given them advice have proven invaluable. And I want to hear from you. If you've had fantastic advice from somebody, if someone has helped you to see a different picture, then let me know. Again, just get in touch, email jamie@sheffieldlive.org, send a text 07904 272 200, or find me on Twitter. And if you want to talk anonymously, or if you want to be on the record, put yourself forward to be on the program, or suggest someone who you think has been a fantastic mentor to you and they should come on the program, then please do just get in touch. And whether you are a business owner, whether you're running a social enterprise, whether you're self-employed, I'm always keen to hear from you. So without further ado, I think it's time to bring Jodie Marshall in and onto the show. Jodie's been sitting here patiently in the studio. Jodie, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm all right. Thank you. Not bad.
Good, good. Thanks so much for coming in today.
And you're welcome.
It's not your first visit to this program, but it's been a while.
No, it has been a while. Yeah. I think I've been on a few times, but it's been a while.
Absolutely. Yes. And I wanted to invite you back on because your business, a Mind Apart Theatre Company, a social enterprise using performing arts. Well, actually, I'm going to ask you to describe it in your words in a moment, but you're celebrating your 10th anniversary. So
yes,
congratulations.
Thank you.
Well done. Tell me then, to start with, what a Mind Apart does, who you work with, and why you do it.
Okay, so we specialise in using performing arts in various different ways, with our focus being using it to engage everybody and make it accessible to all, whilst also encouraging personal and social change within it. So that goes from working with children and young people right through to working with adults and running adult courses too.
Okay, grand. So fairly diverse there in terms of the people you work with. So why did you do it? Why did you set up the business?
So I set up the business after working in Brazil and working with street children.
Yeah.
And that's actually where the idea came from. And initially, I wanted to be over there. Yeah. And I came back to the UK and for various reasons didn't go back over there to live as I'd intended initially, and did my drama degree in Lincoln University. Mm-hmm. Fell in love with a social political theatre technique called Theatre of the Oppressed, and realised that actually this was the tool that I could use to do what I wanted to do. Went and had extra training in it, and now I specialise in using that, and I've developed within that my own techniques as well, as well as using other people's. So, well, yeah.
Grand, super. So, Brazil.
Yep.
Did you speak Portuguese when you were...
Yes, so I didn't initially. So I learned it while I was out there. And then over the years, so I've been going to and fro in for about 14 years now, and I'm the trust of a charity that supports work out there here in the UK. I learned it basically just as I went out every time. So I speak it pretty much fluently now. I don't get to speak it as much as I like, but a few years ago I went back and actually trained a series of professionals in the work, the techniques that we use here. So we have a training course that we run here around working with young people with challenging behaviour. And I translated it to Portuguese and taught it in Portuguese. So that was an experience.
Yeah. Grand.
So yeah, and I was on the local TV station there as well, like their equivalent of the BBC.
Yeah.
And that was broadcast kind of across a lot of the country.
So, yeah. Fantastic. Super. Now tell me more then about the technique, Theatre of the Oppressed.
Yep. Okay, so it's a performing arts technique that focuses on social change.
Yeah.
It came from Brazil. It came from a guy called Augusto Boal. And basically Boal saw that there were so many social injustices, but he wanted to use his training in professional theatre. So he was the director of the Arena Theatre in Sao Paulo for a long time, but it wasn't enough for him. So he was, you know, putting on the classics, Ibsen and the classics. Mm. And it wasn't enough. So he could see it affecting people, but not really changing them. Right. Which is very how theatre is seen in Brazil. So he took it into the favelas and he took his work into the favelas and started to develop something called legislative theatre, which he was actually a party member of the social party in Brazil. And he basically took it into the meetings to explore how do we change legislation, what would it look like, and to start role-playing what would happen if these legislations were changed. And then that moved into working in the favelas and getting the participants involved. So after many years of developing it, he realised that the key to this was, okay, it's fine to have actors, but the actors are not the ones that are going to go and fight the political battles or go and make the change. Mm-hmm. So we need to get the participants involved. And he calls them the spectactors instead of spectators. Right.
Grand. Now, you say you've investigated, you became fascinated by this technique, you wanted to use it yourself, and you've developed, if you like, your own iterations on it too. So what have you been doing?
So A Mind Apart has a very specific methodology that if you work for me and you don't get it, you don't last very long because it's that ingrained in us. And it starts with the principle that no matter who the person is we're working with, who the young person is, the adult, the child, if you can't love them unconditionally, then you can't work successfully with them. Mm-hmm. Because we're dealing with kids that can be quite frankly nasty, or they can appear nasty. Their behaviour is very challenging. You know, we've had chairs thrown, we've had police have to be called. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with kids who have spent a whole lifetime of being abused in some way or another, whether it's through parents, family, or through friends. They don't connect with the education system. And they feel like they have been failed time and time and time again. So for me, it was really important that has to be within everything that we do. And we have to be there no matter what. So we show up. If they don't show up, that's okay. We'll show up again until they do show up.
Right.
And that's kind of the principle. So that's the mindset that kind of my staff have to have. And then within that, we have a very set way of running the session. So we start with something called a check-in, which is about basically dumping things. So it's, and it can be anything from the kids just blurring out how they're feeling, having a good moan, having a rant because they've just had an argument with somebody, to kind of responding to a question that connects to the rest of the session. Mm-hmm. And then the session is based kind of whatever happens in that session, depending on the service. And then finishing the session, we finish with an evaluation and how it connects to our lives and how is that going to connect to the change that we might make. And that model happens no matter what A Mind Apart session you do, whether it's an after-school club, an evening class, or kind of our day work with difficult kids, every session structure is the same.
Right.
So a child going to a mind apart in Sharrow can go to a holiday club in Shire Green and they get the same format.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what teacher they're with, they know this is how a mind apart is.
So this is your structure, this is
yeah.
your process.
Yeah, and part of the reasoning for that is because we actually specialise in bringing young people and children who wouldn't normally be able to engage in performing arts into the fold. So we have a lot of children on our evening classes and after school clubs that have got SEN needs, so that's special educational needs. And often parents come to us saying, we've tried them at this course, we've tried them on this performing arts group, and none of them fit, and they just get excluded.
Right.
And they're not cared for. So we actually specialise in bringing them into the fold and actually integrating them with other young people and students that have not got the special educational needs. And often those students become the mentors as well.
Right.
And then that feeds back into their school life as well.
Yes, I'm sure you see it. So,
yeah.
So this is an engagement over a period of months, years with some of your
yeah
young
so
people.
Yeah, so it depends what service they're part of. So if they're part of our day work, which is based on schools referring them to
yeah.
us, they can be with us from a term, so that's usually half a term, 6 weeks, and then
yeah.
a full term is anything 12 to 13 weeks. So they could be with us for half term or a full term or an entire year. Sometimes they're with us one day a week. Sometimes they're with us 3 or 4 days a week.
Yeah.
And that can vary. Sometimes they're with us for 3 years within that. So it's absolutely dependent on the child's situation and on whether the school are willing to refer and continue that referral.
Yeah.
So if the school feel it's not benefiting them, they often will pull the referral.
Right, okay.
So they have control of that. With our evening classes and our after-school clubs, it's the parents that pay for it. So
yep.
it's a paid service. We keep the fee as low as we possibly can. But the idea there is that it's accessible and that it's kind of a place of creativity for the young people. So, and in that situation, it's about working with the parents. And
right.
to maintain the child being there. So we've got children that have been with us. I mean, one of our children, Molly, she's now 15. She started with us when she was 5. So she's
okay.
been with us the whole 10 years.
Goodness me. That's
so
amazing.
Yeah, so we've got a couple of children like that and then others that have been like 7, 6.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Excellent.
So it's good.
Superb. So you must be proud of so many things that you've done and that A Mind Apart has done, and how the people you work with have been able to thrive thanks to what you're doing over the 10 years.
Yeah.
I mean, does anything stand out? What are you most proud of in the 10 years that you've been running?
I think I find this quite a hard question to answer, because I think when you run a business, it's never good enough. I think real entrepreneurs and real business people and CEOs are never happy.
No.
It's all, you kind of do it and you want the next thing.
Yeah.
So I'm quite quick to think, well, it's not good enough, but we could have reached more. But when I did the sums for this, we work on average throughout all of our services and schools work, we work approximately with about 1,000 kids a year.
Right.
Okay. And usually about 300 of those kids are weekly classes, so we see them on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. So when I worked that out, when I averaged it out over 10 years, that's 10,000 kids. Now, knock a couple of thousand off, because the first 2 years we weren't reaching that. So let's say 8,000 kids.
Yeah.
That's in 10 years. That's quite huge when you...
It's
you know,
is.
That's like 0.... I think I worked it out as 0.17% of the Sheffield population. It was something which actually is quite a big number when you're just looking at children. Now, some of those children are now grown up.
Mm.
So now they're in their early 20s and they've had kids and they're sending their kids. So there, then you start to think, you start to feel old. But then, especially when they beat you to having kids. But then also you start to think, actually, there's a real impact happening here. Because it becomes
is.
A generational impact.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think with the kids we're working with, that's the key. It's the generational cycle that we're trying to break.
Yeah. And that's not an easy thing to
not
do.
Not at all.
No.
Not at all.
Okay, that's really interesting answer to a difficult question there. I want to ask you in a moment about, I suppose, what you've learned as well in the 10 years and what you've changed in the 10 years. Yep. But before I do that, I think something you've said in response to first question leads to another natural question, really, because you've talked about how some of the income comes in terms of parents paying for some sessions.
Yep.
You keep the price as low as possible. You have schools referring as well. And you do bid for contracts as well. I suppose you bid as a minder part and in collaboration or consortia as well, perhaps.
Yep.
Perhaps you can tell me more about how you secure income and the various income streams that you use to create sustainability for the social enterprise.
Okay. So in the early days, I set it up in 2008. So that was the recession hit big time. And my theory was, if I could do it in a recession and it can be a growing business, then when the recession passes, if it ever passes, then great, it'll be kind of thriving. And as part of that, I was also very strict that I wasn't going to go for Arts Council funding at that point. Partly because it was just such a mess at that time. And as years gone on, I've realised that it's abused quite a lot by a lot of charities. And I've seen charities within the sector very close to home really abusing kind of the funding and how it's used. And so for me, it's never... I've always kind of wanted to keep a bit of a distance of it because... I don't actually believe that total funding is sustainability. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe in the charity model within the arts sector anymore. I don't think it's sustainable anymore.
Right. Sorry to interrupt. Yes. How do charities abuse it then? What do you mean
Well,
by
I
that?
I think politically, there's always... The Arts Council can be very political. So sometimes it's to do with the connections you've got. Sometimes they take the money and then they're not really using it for what it's intended for. And maybe they're part declaring things or, you know, so it's kind of, it's a very grey area, I think. And I think if you get money for funding, it needs to be used for that purpose. And I think it's too easy to kind of move how you use that money or, you know, play with it, I guess. And when you do this all of the time and you're doing it with lots of different funders, there's a question mark over it for me because that's not sustainability. That's you playing politics. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's an element of politics that needs to be played in business, but should we be playing politics with public money? Because that's what it is, you know?
Yes, and I suppose that we've often seen organisations do something that actually they wouldn't do, weren't necessarily core to their vision and values, and they're only doing it because they're trying to do what a funder wants and diverting themselves. Okay, so really interesting, and I've taken us just off track there slightly because, but an interesting off track in terms of the reasons why you didn't when you launched in 2008 go for Arts Council funding, and perhaps some of what you've seen and noticed in terms of the pitfalls of that. So we're talking then about how you achieve income and revenue and sustainability and the different sources of income that you secure.
Yeah. So there's so we have various different streams to what we do. Yeah. So that if one area kind of dips a little bit, like our education did at the beginning of September, we can pull it up in other areas.
Right.
So I've created a model that is very easy to diversify when we need to.
Right.
So within that, we've got evening classes and after-school clubs, which are fee-based.
Yep.
So they're generally self-sustainable. They generally don't make a lot of profit, but they feed into the salaries of the staff that are teaching those sessions. We've then got the education work, which is contract based. So I think at the moment we've got 3 or 4 contracts with the local authority in various different capacities. And that's contract based. Sometimes it's per hour based. Sometimes it's per student based,
right,
depending on the contract. So again, they make that area sustainable. There may be occasionally a tiny bit of profit in that, depending on numbers on students. But generally, that doesn't really bring in profit.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other stuff we've got is the holiday clubs.
Yep.
We've got events. Mm-hmm. So we started events a few years ago and we just started drip feeding it in. And the events started to make us a bit of profit that we could feed back into the areas where we were losing the profit, such as the day work. And so this is something that in the last year I've actually taken on somebody to manage the events. Mm. And within that, we then get sponsorship for them. So, you know, we'll get somebody to say, well, we want to sponsor the food for this event. We did an alternative prom last year, which was for students who couldn't attend their school prom for whatever reason. And that was really successful. And we managed to pull in sponsorship from businesses for that. And then the other thing that we've launched this year is the adult courses,
right,
which, again, bit more profitable for us. But what it means is it means that that money gets moved over to the areas where, yes, maybe we're not making that money, so it's not going into pockets. But that has been booming actually this year, and we've actually got tomorrow we've got a improvisation course workshop running as well tomorrow, which we've got quite a lot booked onto, and we've just had an improv course that's been delivered. So we're stepping into the improv world as well, and I've got a specialist who's quite well known in Sheffield on the scene.
That's exciting.
And yeah, it is exciting because it's massive in America, mm, and nobody's doing it here. So I think I can say that we're leading the way in it a little bit.
Brilliant.
In terms of performing arts companies doing it.
That's fantastic. So, yeah. So it's a model where people are very happy to pay for, say, those adult courses. And
yeah.
I imagine as well that whilst you say they're profitable for you, the fee that people are paying is a fee that people are very happy to pay. There's nothing wrong with profit.
Yeah,
it's then allowing you to cross-subsidise things that you don't make money, yeah, on and achieve social impact as well. So
yeah, huge, and even the adult courses, they're not expensive.
No.
So an 8-week course and the sessions were 2 hours a week was £80.
Right.
So that's not a lot. That's really low, actually.
No, it's not a lot at all, is it?
And I would, in many ways, I would like to up the price of that. But I also acknowledge that we have objectives that is about accessibility.
Yes.
So once you up it, you're then cutting off a load of people that wouldn't be able to access it.
Right. Yeah, indeed. So you've clearly thought really hard about not being dependent on one stream of revenue. And if, say, an area dips, you mentioned education dipping in September, then you're not in sort of panic mode because, mm-hmm, you have diverse revenue streams dependent on different factors. So yeah,
I think we have been in panic mode with it, and I think we hit panic mode in September.
Right,
but I always think sometimes panic mode is really good, because if I then say to the staff, look, this is the situation, and I'm very transparent and honest about it. This is the situation. This is about your jobs as much as it is about the company. We've got to hit the ground running,
yep,
and we've got to think. So actually it develops a creativity in your team where suddenly they're going, but we could do this, we could do that. And that's where the adult courses came from. And that's where the going back into schools, which is one of the first things we used to do.
Yep.
That came from there. And actually, now that we're in April, compared to, so our financial year is April to April, compared to last year, we've actually increased our education income by 7% this year. And it was looking an impossible year in September because,
right,
our referrals basically dropped quite drastically, as did a lot of other alternative providers in the city.
Okay.
So somehow we've pulled that round. And I think part of that is being able to diversify so quickly.
Yes.
And having the flexibility to then release your staff to go and do what they think needs to be done, being the people on the ground with the contacts a lot of the time.
Right. So that diversification, that flexibility and that encouragement of your staff's creativity.
Yeah.
Creativity is, of course, what they do.
Yeah.
But we're talking creativity in business as well, in terms of coming up with new ideas.
Yeah. And teaching them to. So I guess part of the way that I manage them, I have a coaching management culture. So I don't micromanage really. And so part of the way I manage them is to give them the space to develop themselves.
Right.
And to just explore and experiment. And if it goes wrong, it goes wrong. I mean, sometimes they get it from me if it goes wrong, but sometimes that's good. You know, that's because if I know they can do it, but they don't know that, sometimes it's good to have a bit of a, what happened there? And then suddenly they bring it back next time and it's amazing.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I like to work, and throwing them in the deep end a little bit sometimes. We work a lot with graduates.
Yeah.
So they often get thrown in the deep end.
Right, okay.
But again, it's not a bad thing because the universities don't prepare them very well. So no. Welcome to the real world.
Welcome to the real world from you, yeah. Okay. How many staff do you have at the moment?
So I've got about seven.
Yeah.
Seven staff, part-time and full-time. Yeah.
Grand. So, wow, I've got so many more questions to ask. This is fabulous. 10 years of running, what have you learned? What have you changed about how you run? Her mind apart?
Delegation and control, I reckon. Mm. So I met a friend about a year ago, possibly, or maybe a year and a half ago. And I remember talking to him because he's been really successful in taking his business from Sheffield and actually expanding it, which is one of the things I want to do, go into other cities. And I just said to him, I can't see how. Like, I want to do it, I can see how, but time-wise, physically, I can't see how. And he just said to me, unless you get on the business and stay on the business and let your staff make the mistakes, it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to let them manage and make the mistakes. And that's really stuck with me over the last year and a half. So I'm now kind of getting to the place where I'm trying to get it to that place where I let them manage it and trust that they know. So I guess delegation has been a big thing.
Okay.
And it wasn't until I went to Brazil for 3 weeks, about 5 years ago, I think it must be now, and left the business in my manager's hand, the girl that manages it with me. And left in her hands, and then came back and realized it was all okay. It was still a lie. Like, that was a release.
Sometimes that's what it takes, a big trip where you're going to be away for 3 weeks.
Absolutely.
To do what you've wanted to try and do in terms of delegation.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I actually remember telling my business mentor, Faye Smith, to do the same thing when she went to Australia, and she came back and she said, you were so like, yeah. I listened to what you said,
yeah,
because, you know, I did it and I said, this is what you've got to do. Make yourself do it. And I think you do. You come back and suddenly everything gets put back into perspective.
Yeah.
And kind of go, oh, it's not as bad. Oh, I can survive. Why am I killing myself?
Yeah. Perspective change again, actually. So great. Okay. So I suppose in terms of what you've changed most about how you run it, that is that. I mean, I was going to also ask what you know now that you wish you'd known when you started. And would that be the same thing, or is there anything else? Or any...
That we would still be here 10 years on.
Yeah, well, yes.
If I'd have known that, I think I'd have been a lot easier on myself.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. Maybe I'd have been harsher on myself because maybe I would have expected more as a young... Because I started it when I was 21. So, you know, as a young 21-year-old, maybe I'd have gone... Be harsher, be here in 10 years. Also, I think the knowledge that actually you might have plans, but they don't always happen. Things change, and it's okay to be okay with that change.
Right.
Because I think a long time ago, I used to have to be like this, must be this way, must be in control of it. And I think I've gone from one extreme to the other. Now that I hate being in control of things. And, you know, somebody said to me recently, oh, I bet you're loving planning your wedding because, you know, like, you love doing events management. And I just laughed and said, I don't do it. I pay somebody to do it. Like, I don't do my events management in my company. I hate it. So I think, you know, learning what are you good at and what do you enjoy.
Right.
And giving the things you don't like to the person that likes it.
Yes.
You know, because more's going to get done and it's going to be more efficient.
More will be, yes, grand. Okay, super. That's fabulous. So, challenges. What you 10 years, every business, every social enterprise faces challenges. What are the biggest, what are the most difficult and daunting challenges that you have faced?
I would say for us, it's political. It's always political and economical because we are so reliant on education contracts.
And education's a political football, isn't it?
Massively so. Massively. So I think the... and actually, I think one of the biggest threats for me was when they changed the curriculum to make it much more English, maths and science focused and took a lot of the creativity out of
right.
it. There was a real uncertainty there on where we would sit. But actually, I think it's done us a favour because although I don't agree with the decision that was made, from a, if I'm kind of looking at it from above, from a business perspective, more people want to engage with the arts. And if they can't do it at school, they come outside of school or the schools bring it in.
Right.
So because the teachers still want it, but it's just that it's not supposed to, you know, they don't want it on the curriculum as much from the governments.
So the teachers still want it? And
I think a lot do, yeah. I think a lot value it, but they are stuck to having to fulfil the quota, getting qualifications.
Yeah.
Even in primary, you know, you've still got the stress of SATs.
Right.
And I think we're knocking it out of we're knocking creativity out of the system a lot earlier than it used to be knocked out of the system.
Yeah.
And actually, I think what the government doesn't realise is it's creativity that develops businesses.
Yes. Well, of course, it really, really is. Now, I'm going to take us down another diversion because of something you've just said, mm-hmm. Jodie. Because last week I noticed that a longitudinal study adapted into the school curriculum was published, and it found that structured music lessons significantly enhanced children's cognitive abilities.
Absolutely.
Language, reasoning, short-term memory, planning, and lead to improved academic performance.
Yep.
And this was a huge study that also incorporated visual art lessons, and it's been published on sciencedaily.com, and it's perhaps well worth people in the arts, people in music who want to engage with schools looking at this, because music education and arts education has suffered, as you say. So this came from a question about biggest challenges you've faced, and but you sort of said how those challenges are challenging and how education and the curriculum has changed, but it has also perhaps opened up opportunities for online part too.
Yeah. I think the other challenge I would say has been the Brexit.
Yeah.
We had an international programme where we were, it was like an international gap year programme where people across Europe were coming to us, and we piloted it with EU money and then continued it. And they were coming to us and basically paying for training from us. So it was one-to-one training. It was hands-on training. We would provide them with a host, so they would stay with a family in Sheffield. They got travel across Sheffield, and then we would take them to different places and engage them in the community aspect of the city. And we got some real momentum on it. And we started to see that this was really good. And also it was a way for me to get my methodology international.
Yes.
And the people that were coming really valued it. And a lot of them have gone into the sector and, you know, come out of university. And some universities were able to give the students funding for it. And
right.
So it was a model that worked. And then Brexit happened. And I went, oh, man.
Yeah.
So I thought I put the brakes on it. And I guess regrets-wise, I wish I hadn't put the brakes on it the year that we voted for the referendum, because actually I could have continued it up until at least this point and we could have still been going up until next year.
Right, yeah.
But because it was so uncertain and because we'd got so much other stuff going on, I had to make a decision. And so I put the brakes on it until I knew clear it. And actually, I think I should have taken the risk.
Okay, well, it's a demonstration of how uncertainty can lead to a lack of confidence, and that can lead to a decision that sometimes you regret.
Yeah, I think the lack of confidence for me was in the government.
Mm.
I think my lack of confidence was I have got no confidence that they're going to do this well. And how much do I want my business to be stuck in the middle of that?
Right.
I guess.
Yeah.
But if I could go back 3 years. Is it 3 years?
Yeah, it's nearly two. Since
so if I could go back 2 or 3 years, I think the decisions would be different.
Right, sure. Okay, well, easy to see things in retrospect and say, okay. But it's then moving on, isn't
it?
Contracts and collaborative bidding, consortium bidding, and bidding on your own as a mind apart. So we talked a little bit about this earlier on, but I'd like, if I may, to ask you for your advice in terms of how businesses and how social enterprises can successfully prepare themselves to be, if you like, tender ready, ready to bid, fit to tender, and how to secure contracts and bids.
Okay, so I think that partnership work is a great way to start. I think that's how we started. We started partnering with Sheffield College and with other consortiums,
right?
And that was. That worked great. It's a great way to get your foot in the door with the local authorities. So if you're going into local authority bids and things like that, great way to get started with that.
Yeah.
And then other than that, I think when you're tendering and you're bidding, I think you've got to have a level of obnoxiousness about it.
Right.
So I think you've got to be realistic, but not undersell yourself. And I think that's what people struggle with. It's like when it's like if you were to have a public speaker that just wasn't very good at writing their biography, you know, to get out to the event organisers. Kind of, you've got to sell yourself. If you can't sell yourself, you're not going to achieve the thing that you need to achieve, basically.
Okay.
So for me, I would say, and also I would say to try it, to just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the other thing, that you can sit there and when you're first starting out worrying about it, is the terminology right? Is it not right? Well, if it's not right, you can always ask for feedback. And most local authorities want to, although the structure is sometimes hard to get into, they do want to and they have to be working with local businesses.
Yes.
So it's just about learning what it is that they would like from you and finding out whether you can achieve that.
Okay, grand. And so it's a case of you started with partnership working.
Yep.
That allowed you to perhaps build up a track record so that you could bid on your own account and say that you had a successful track record of delivering contracts in partnership. Then, and we most probably we all know that when you're bidding against a tender, you have to be very clear to answer the specific criteria that they do, but don't undersell yourself. Sort of be strong and clear about what you do, how you do it, and what makes you unique and ideal to do it.
Absolutely. Okay.
Grand. That, I think, is very, very helpful. And I love the sort of be obnoxious, but be realistic.
Yeah.
That was great. Super. Okay, good. So Sheffield, as a place to do business and as a place that supports small businesses and that supports small social enterprises.
Yeah.
Do you have views?
I think Sheffield is a great city for social enterprises. It's served me really well in my social enterprise. It's got the Sheffield Hallam University that has got kind of all the social enterprise course, which I did my master's at.
Yeah.
On social enterprise. It's got companies that are community share focused.
Yep.
I think it's an absolutely thriving city for a social enterprise. I don't think that enough support is put into it, both from central government and local government.
Right.
But I think that there's a real resilience from northern people, just generally, isn't there? And
there
I think
indeed.
That shows with the Social Enterprise Network in Sheffield.
Okay, great. Super positive comments there. Now, who has helped you? You mentioned a mentor.
Yes.
You've posted on your personal or company Facebook page about A Mind Apart celebrating 10 years.
Yes.
And you've tagged a number of people who helped you. So your chance now on radio to give some positive shout out for people who have supported A Mind Apart.
Okay, so friends and family, because they put up with a lot. But also Faye Smith from Keep Your Fork. She's definitely one of the most key people. Mm-hmm. For me, she's mentored me right from the beginning, really. She's also a Christian, so she gives me the spiritual input as well as the business input, and has helped me to really align my ethics and kind of my beliefs in line with my business as well, which has been quite important.
You have faith.
So. Yeah. Mm. So I'm a Christian as well. And BBC Radio Sheffield, if I'm allowed, have been very supportive.
Fabulous. Great.
As have Sheffield Live as well. So really the local media, I would say, the Star, the Telegraph, you know, all the local papers, they will always publish things that we send to them. Massively supportive, which is a lot to do with Faye, because mm-hmm. you know, she was the first one to get recommended. But I think what I find with the local media is that they're very loyal.
Right.
I think we've got a very loyal local media, where if they see something that they can really see the value of, and they really see that you believe it and it's positive, they want to, you know, they want to show it off, basically.
Right.
So I'm always really grateful for that.
Super. Well, there's a call out here, folks, to support your local media. If you want the Star and the Telegraph and the Yorkshire Post to carry on existing, then buy their newspapers. Listen to BBC Radio Sheffield and listen to Sheffield Live.
Yes, definitely.
And so, great. So sorry, Jody, I diverted you there.
That's fine. Who else? So Natasha Hargrove, who she's been with me in the company for 9 years. Mm-hmm. So she started off teaching 1 hour a week, traveling the length of the city, not making any money on it.
Right.
Because I paid so low then. She stuck with it through thick and thin. And I think if you dared to say anything bad about me to her, I think she'd have you. Okay. That's how loyal she is. there's not many people in my life that are that loyal. So she's like, I couldn't have done it without her. She's been a key person in it. And she now manages a lot of it for me.
Yes, I see.
And then the team that I've got at the moment, I've got a really incredible team at the moment, and I think we've got through a tough year. And I wouldn't have been able to without them again. So, and the parents that support us.
Wonderful.
All of the parents, all the thousand of parents that we have and engage with and have engaged with.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't believe in it and don't send their kids, then we don't exist.
No, quite. So. Okay, lovely. Okay, thank you so much for that. Now, I want to turn to something which is a really big issue. You were really candid about domestic violence and you published a column. It was published in both the Yorkshire Post and the Sheffield Telegraph mm-hmm. last October about breaking the taboo of domestic abuse. And that was then widely shared, and you must have had a lot of reaction to it from readers as well. And I wanted to ask, first of all, what sort of response you actually received after publishing that column, after writing that column, and whether you think that social enterprises and that businesses should or could be doing more in terms of speaking out about this or about other issues that affect lots and lots of people and yet can be difficult to address or difficult for some people to feel able to talk about.
Okay, so first of all, the response I got was really positive. And I think it was positive because only a few people have been on that journey with me. So for anybody that hasn't read the articles, I was in an abusive relationship for around a year. And that's what the article was sharing. And it was talking about actually the lack of support within the system.
Yeah.
The media gave me a positive response, but the problem that you have with the media is that they cannot publish anything that gives a name. And they can't publish anything that could point towards that person. So even just the fact that it's me, if that person picks up on that, it could cause issues, which I absolutely understand. And the other problem you've got with the media is that telling somebody's story third hand or second hand, it doesn't sell. What sells are names and convictions. But in this area of domestic abuse, and we see this in sexual exploitation with our young girls as well. We had a case last year. They don't get convictions. It's very hard to get a conviction because the evidence is very hard to prove.
Yep.
And it's only recently that a bill has gone through Parliament, or I think could be still going through, where it's actually seen as a crime. Whereas before, the police officers would call it a domestic.
Mm.
So it's only even recently that it's recognised legally. So if you've got no legal laws on it, then it can become a taboo, and it does become a taboo. So I think this is part of the problem, that you have women like and men like myself who have gone through it. I didn't have children, so I wasn't classed as priority. I managed to get him out of the house. So even though he turned upon my doorstep quite a few times and managed to get himself into my building, so I live in a flat, and potentially could have been quite dangerous, I wasn't classed as kind of urgent.
Right.
So because he wasn't living with me anymore. So when you take that into account, it means that the support I got was practically none. I mean, even as a Christian, the support from the church, quite frankly, was atrocious.
Was it?
I have a very small group of people that I can count on my hand that walked with me through that journey, that are right. Christians that stuck by me. And actually, the way that people in the church dealt with me and reacted to it was so negative that I left going to church.
Right, okay.
And I think because actually I didn't want that judgment, because you're judged enough in the relationship.
Yeah.
So I think we have to, in Christian circles, we have to stop pretending that this doesn't exist, and we have to find ways of being able to relate to these people that, because, you know, charity started in churches.
Mm.
So we have to find ways of relating to these people and understanding what they're going through, whether it's domestic abuse, whether it's alcoholism, whether it's addicted to drugs, whatever they're going through, we need to take the judgment out of it.
Yes.
Because it's all circumstantial.
And I'm asking around whether social enterprises and businesses, yes. because in some ways it's a community, whether people have a faith or not,
yeah.
Again, there is the taboo issue.
Yeah.
You face it as a Christian, as you've described,
mm-hmm.
but people who might feel that they have very supportive colleagues and workmates or a very supportive boss, they may find that if they're asking for support when they're confronting an issue like this, suddenly the support isn't there, as,
yeah.
as you've found. So there is a taboo issue, and can businesses, and I'm really sorry because we're very nearly out of time actually, but can businesses and social enterprises themselves, and you're a business leader, a social
I think,
entrepreneur,
I think
can they
can.
Do more?
I think yeah. they can do more. I think managers and bosses can do more to support people in their business that might be dealing with these issues. I think they can connect with charities and
yes.
other voluntary sector organisations that are working around these issues to signpost. They can put things up around work, because it is something that you don't always want to tell your boss about.
Mm.
But, you know, you can put things in the toilets, you can put posters up. So I think there are very small things that businesses and social enterprises can do. But for me, I think the key thing is that if you are running a business or a social enterprise, you need to be supportive in some way of this. And you need to do everything you can to help this person get through it. And that might be giving them time off, but it also might be allowing them to just plunge in and work really hard.
Right.
Because that's what I needed to do.
So be supportive.
And I think be flexible as much as possible with it, because it's never clear cut and it's never simple.
Okay.
And it's a very complex area, really.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being so candid about that.
Thank you.
On the programme today. I want to finish with a very, very brief description
mm-hmm.
of your aspirations then for the next year and the next 10 years. You're going to have to summarise this in seconds, really,
okay.
I'm afraid, Jodie.
To grow nationally.
Fantastic. That was brilliant.
Well,
I asked you to do it briefly. That was superb. That's absolutely great. Now, people can find out more about A Mind
yes.
Apart.
Yes.
You're on social media. You
yep.
have a website. Do you want to give the links out
yep.
to the website?
So it's amindapart.com. amindapart.org.uk. So amindapart.org.uk.
Fantastic. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming
in
today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Really good chat. You've been listening to Jodie Marshall, Managing Director of A Mind Apart Theatre Company Limited, joining me on Sheffield Live today. If you've only just tuned in and you've missed the interview, don't panic. The podcast will be up on the Sheffield Live podcast section of the website later on today from about 11 a.m. Just go to sheffieldlive.org, look up radio shows, find Business Live, and the podcast from today will be there. That's it for today. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you, Jodie, for a fascinating, really wide-ranging, interesting interview. Thank you, Sangeeta, in the studio with us, a sound engineer. Next up on Sheffield Live, our fantastic folk music programme, Thank Goodness It's Folk, from 10 all the way through to noon. And we'll play out with a bit of Roy Scop.
Made in Sheffield, made by you.
This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for Business Live.